Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hello, I'm Susan Violante. I'm your host for today. I'm really excited to be speaking on the phone with Lina Simoni, author of The House of Serenade, a portrait of upper-class life in Genova of 1910. The Barillis are a wealthy and powerful upper-class family in love with their social status. As one by one, the Barillis violently or gently disappear, what survives them and stems from their ruins is the music Ivano, the son of a baker, continues to play on his mandolin under the windows of Caterina's house. But before we start, let's learn a little bit about Lina. Lina Simoni was born in Genova, Italy, and moved to the U.S. in 1988. Trained at the Art Institute of Chicago and the Evanston Art Center, she showed her paintings and photographs in galleries in the Midwest, Northeast, Florida, and the South of France. On the literary front, she published two novels, newly published The House of Serenades and the award-winning The Scent of Roses Oil. Also, a children's book titled Sophia's Rainbow that is also a charity for children's literacy programs. Lina currently lives in California with her two Cocker Spaniels, Biscuit and Simon. Her hobbies are movies, tennis, and jazz. For more information about Lina, visit www.linasimoni.com. Hi, Lina. How are you today?
Hello. I'm fine. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us today in Inside Scoop Live.
And thank you for having me.
I'm very excited to interview you because we have a couple of things in common that I found out when I was actually visiting your website and learning a little bit more about your background. So this is going to be a lot of fun. But before we start, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Well, I was born in Genoa, Italy. Genoa is a big port and has a big significance for the American culture because that's where all the ships with the immigrants, you know, from not only from Italy but from other parts of Europe went to Ellis Island. So so I was born in Italy, in Genoa, and I came to the United States in 1988. I was about 30 years old at the time, and I've been living in the States in various different places ever since. But I came because of the job that they offered me, and at the time, I was no writer. I was a scientist, and so MIT hired me, and I spent 3 years there, and then other universities hired me after that. And so for about 15 years, I was a university professor.
And you know what? That was the last thing I imagined to find in your bio, is that you were not just an accomplished writer of a literary novel, but also you were a scientist, because usually scientists will write about sci-fi and or, you know, research and stuff like
you
that.
You know, it's interesting you're saying that, because for me, once I decided that I wanted to give up science, I just totally gave it up. And, you know, I decided that I wanted to be a writer, and so I started writing about other things entirely.
Yeah.
It was like a very sharp cut with my past.
It's you know, that's actually, I'm curious about that. How did that happen? How did you decide to totally change your, because a lot of people identify by what they do. So
right.
It was a total change of life, you know.
It was a total change of life, but it didn't happen overnight. At some point, I was not happy with my work anymore. You know, it's the direction that my life was taking. I was absolutely miserable going to work. And so I started writing during weekends just to, you know, soothe my distress and relax and just take my head off things that were bothering me. So that's how it started. And once I started, it was just like a whole new world opened in front of me. And, I mean, of course, the first things I wrote during those weekends while I was still working were horrible. I still have them, and once in a while I look at them and I cannot believe that I wrote such garbage. But the point is that, like I said, the whole world opened for me. And once I did that, you know, consistently over and over for several months, I realized that that's all I wanted to do, because that was really only the only time in my life that I was happy. And so, I kept my job for a little bit longer because, of course, I had bills to pay.
Yeah.
But then at some point, I just decided to take the plunge. And for a while, so I left my well-paid academic job. And for a while, I was doing some consulting work on the side. So it was little by little that writing became my life,
mm-hmm.
my entire life. Yeah.
So it was like you went to a journey of self-discovery within and discovered the writer in you and decided that that's who you wanted to be.
Absolutely, yes.
That's great. Not a lot of people are lucky enough to go through that journey and, you know, and come out with a happy life afterwards. And how do you feel now that you look, when you look back and you see that person that you were as a scientist beginning to soul search? Because she was not happy. Did you have any idea that you will, you know, end up publishing more than one book and you know, doing all the art? Because you're also an artist.
Yes.
Did you? What would you tell that person who you were before, you know, you took the plunge?
Sometimes things happen for a reason, and I think that all the misery I was in with my, you know, academic work and is the one that actually offered me the opportunity to discover myself. So I'm not unhappy that happened, and it just happened, and I'm happy it did. But, you know, the message that I can offer our listeners is don't settle for something you don't like. Just, to, you know, try to better your life and because then, even though you will go through some struggle, I think your life will get better at some point.
And you know, it is so true. I also got a political science major in Venezuela, and my first job was a general director of a foundation where Audubon sat in the board of directors. And I loved the job, and then I was very disappointed because I realized that it was all a scam from the people that were killing the Venezuelan alligator.
Mm.
So I quit my job and started my own pottery studio, and my mom gave me a 1930 typewriter. And I started typing poetry and all in Spanish, you know, just doing all that stuff. And then my job, my career, because I also was a business analyst, is what brought me to the U.S. where I, you know, started writing in English and created my own writer career, and I'm also published my book and all that. So if you would have asked me then, you know, would you go back to school and study whatever you study, I would say no when I was very unhappy. But looking through it now is what opened my doors to have the life I have
now. Exactly. I mean, if it hadn't been for my scientific job, I would have never come to the U.S., first of all. And so I have to be grateful that things went the way they went. I guess it was a necessary step.
Mm-hmm.
For me to come to this new life.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's part of who we are, and we need to embrace that too. So I'm glad you're talking about, you know, that because people that look at you and look at your website and you know, you look like you made it, and they have no idea that it wasn't like that always, you know?
No, my life was actually very difficult most of the time. So it's only recently that I found a balance and peace and some, you know, very grounded reasons for waking up in the morning. So I am really happy right now, but it hasn't been that way. And I'm sure that my website shows all this happiness.
I love your
That's
website,
right.
By the way.
Right. We don't want to put out there unhappy websites, but it's true. There's a lot of struggle and a lot of hard work behind everything you see about me.
Yeah, especially, you know, just because you decide to change your career and you come to a new country and, you know, you decide, of all things, to be a writer in your second language.
You know, it is, yeah.
So that was basically the beginning of a lot of struggle, and I know because I went through the same type of barrier.
Interesting.
But I think that my background helped me a little bit because I did have a lot of contact with English in where I live, where there were a lot of Americans there for the oil company.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't that difficult for me to take that plunge into the, compared to what I would imagine it would have been for you.
Yeah. Well, I do have a good ear for languages in general. I speak, of course, Italian, English. I also speak fluent French and, reasonable Spanish. And I learn very quickly. So when once I came to the United States, and even before that, because I was in a scientific field, so, you go to conferences and meet mm-hmm. people, and of course the language is English. Once I came to the United States, I learned what I needed to learn to do my job very, very quickly. But then writing fiction is an entirely different matter. So I read a lot, I think. One of the good ways to learn to write well is to pick authors that you admire and say, if I had a magic wand, I would like to be her or him, and read them and deconstruct their writing and analyze it and, do a lot of work that way. But then, besides the fact that I needed to gain, total control of the language in all its aspects, from the sentence structures to the grammar to the vocabulary and so on. But then there is another interesting aspect that I'm sure as a Spanish speaker you may relate to. The sentences in a Latin-based language such as Italian tend to be extremely long and convoluted. Italian has its roots in the Latin language, and it's a Latin oratory, so Cicero, orations, and all the things that the Romans were doing, they were going on and on and on talking, and there's never, a period. You have to turn pages to find a period. So mm-hmm. I was used to that kind of style, and changing in my head to write a more Anglo-Saxon kind of style in which sentences tend to be short and to the point, that was a big struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I first joined writers groups and, critique groups, and people were reading through my sentences, and they were gasping for air because they could not get to the end. And I don't know if any of our listeners have ever read something by Umberto Eco or by Italo Calvino, those famous Italian writers. That's the way they write. So I was born, writing that way, so I had to make a significant change in order to be able to write in English.
Yeah. Did you get discouraged at any point? I know that I got discouraged many times, but I was lucky enough to have mentors and peers that were actually more, they would push me to challenge myself. But it was tough not to get discouraged when you would hear somebody else, in a critique group, you would hear their writing and it was all wonderful rhetoric portion, of a paragraph and then of a description, and then it would be me with my accent getting in the way everywhere,
You can hear my accent. Okay, the thing is, I don't get discouraged very easily, even I'm a tough girl. At the time that I was still in the learning process, of course, I was running into people who could write better than me, who could speak better than me, who could, do those things better than me. But I knew that I was learning, so it didn't bother me at all. Yeah. I didn't let it bother me.
You didn't let it bother you. You would take it more like a challenge, I would imagine.
Yes. And I say, okay, so that's what I need to learn to do. Whenever I heard somebody read their writings and I really liked it, I say, okay, that's
I have fun with my critique. Yeah, I have fun with my critique because I still write. I'm working on my second book of a trilogy, and so I go there and I get critiqued by them, and I tell them, and I've been with them for 6 years, and I tell them, please keep trying to make me cry because that's what they do. But they're in a very professional way, but that's what they do because they're very tough, and that's exactly what I wanted. And I've been through many critique groups. So if you have to give somebody, that comes from a different country and they want to start a writing career or just for themselves, what are maybe 5 tips that you can give them so that they
tips,
can
okay.
get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the first one is read.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to read not just for fun, like when you lie in the sun, you know, in summer and you don't know what to do. You really need to pay attention to, you know, the sentence structures, the words, and the way that the characters are constructed and developed. And the second, which is related to the first, is pick your writers, the ones you read very carefully. You know, you need to pick writers that that you like, but also that write topics that are similar to the ones that you want to write, and just study them. So those are two very important tips. And then keep writing, even when you know that what you're writing is not good. But just don't give up. You know, never ever give up. So that's three. And oh gosh, I don't know that I can think of two more. Those are really important.
The one that helped me a lot was to switch off when I was writing. Switch off the critic inside me, because there's that little voice of me that would say, no, you're not saying it right. And then if I started editing before I was done writing, then I would never finish. But if I put the story down and then start editing, then I would get. That was the most helpful.
Right.
One. Yeah, for me.
And something just came to my mind. Read your writings aloud and tape them, mm-hmm. and then listen to yourself. And this way, I mean, this has been a really eye-opener for me, because when you listen to yourself talking out of a tape recorder or your iPad or whatever you use, you really hear things that are wrong and that are out of place that you would never discover if you just look at your computer screen or a sheet of paper. Mm-hmm. So that's really, really important for me. I always, always read what I write aloud at some point and tape it and then listen to it.
That's very, very wise advice. I sometimes forget to do that, and then I will remember to do that, and I'll start reading out loud for myself. Even when I'm critiquing other people's stuff, it helps me to get things into perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're
yeah.
reading it in your mind, you tend to read what you're thinking a lot of times.
Yeah, and also you know the story, so you don't pay attention as much
mm-hmm.
as you yeah. should. Yeah.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through direct podcast as well as MP3 download for your convenience. Please visit us on InsideScoopLive.com.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Lina Simoni, award-winning author and artist. Stay tuned, because we're going to continue this personal conversation with Lina and learn more about the Italian culture, how to break the language barrier when writing a book in a second language, and strong women versus oppressing cultures. But in the meantime, you can check out her book, The House of Serenades, by visiting her website at www.linasimoni.com, and that is www.linasimoni.com. I was looking through your books, and they seem to all have present in the stories strong female characters. Are they inspired on anyone in particular?
No, they're not inspired on anyone in particular, but I definitely like to write about female characters who face big challenges and who have all the odds in the world against them. And so the two novels that I wrote.
Her background, I wonder why.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. No, I mean, because I had to struggle at several points in my life, I definitely can relate to other people's struggles, and in particular, other women's struggles.
Yeah,
so,
and I bet you that it translates, a lot of lessons that you have learned through your own struggles translate when you're creating these characters.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure it does. Although I try not to write things that are autobiographical because I'm still too much involved emotionally in my life. So I just make my stories up, and I write better when I invent my characters.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure that deep inside, you know, there is a part of me that is in there. But the two novels I wrote, The Scent of Rosa Soil and The House of Serenades, are both set in my hometown in Italy, and they both have female characters in trouble in very different ways. The Scent of Rosa Soil is the story of Rosa, who's a little girl who grows up in a brothel, and her adoptive mother is the brothel owner, and then her best friends are the brothel girls, and then there are all these other characters, you know, sailors and thugs and all the ones that you typically find portside in a Mediterranean city. And so she really needs to find her place in the world and make sense of what's happening around her, and it's very difficult. So that's Rosa. And then The House of Serenades is set in Genoa at the same time, at the beginning of 1900, but up in the hills where the upper class lives. So this is an entirely different environment, but there's still two or three women who are really having a very bad time, and they are abused, and they are, they are abused in many different ways, physically, psychologically, and that was something that was going on a lot in the upper class of the time in Italy, and I'm sure in other European countries. So I wanted to make a statement and bring that to the attention of the readers.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, as Italian women, we both know a lot about cultures that repress women. And and yet look at all the things that we're capable of. So I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about tradition versus feminism?
I would define myself as a feminist, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And coming out of a culture like Italy where, you know, families are very strong, and then religion is very strong because we have the Pope sitting there right in the middle of Italy. And that is, which, you know, doesn't help because I believe that religion can be repressive towards women in
mm-hmm.
many different ways, starting from contraception to, you know, other matters. So it is a struggle when you live in that kind of culture to just say, you know, no, I'm going to ignore all this and be a different person.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that writing about strong female characters made you stronger in a sense also?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Every time one of my characters makes it in the end, I feel so good. It's like, and I know that I invented that character, but it doesn't matter. You know, if you write, you know that characters often takes on a, you know, lives of their own. So that's what happens to me. I'm so happy for them when they make it through all this, you know, stuff they had to go through, and I feel empowered when they win, you know, for sure.
Mm-hmm. I love novels that have women that are strong in Europe because I'm very much in touch with the Europe history since I came from immigrants. It kind of stood present because they didn't evolve. And like, if when you stay in your country, you evolve with it. But when you move away, then you stay who you are in a sense. You stop evolving like them. Your idea of that country stayed, you know, in the 1988 when you left. It's my point of view. That's how my parents stay. When they went to Venezuela in the 50s, that's how they think. They think like the Italians of the 50s.
Of the time, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, for me, it's a little bit different because I've been going back often.
Mm-hmm.
I had a son who is now 27 years old, and after college he decided to go and live in Italy, so he's there now. And when I came to the United States, I had just gotten divorced from his father, so his father lived there. And so because I really wanted my son to grow up bilingual and to have a relationship with his father. So even when he was little, we took several trips to Italy. So I sort of, you know, kept that thread going. But it's definitely true that I don't relate anymore to the people that once used to be my friends because their lives have gone in entirely different directions from mine. So when I go back there, I'm like, what do I do now? I feel, you know, like a fish out of water at times.
Mm-hmm.
So my solution is I go there when I missed, you know, the good food and the, you know, the social life and everything, but I don't stay very long. I come back to California quickly,
mm-hmm.
and so that works for me.
Yeah, and I'm the same way. I lived in Rome for a year, and actually people would tell me that I spoke, my friends of my age during that time, it was around the 92s, they would tell me that I spoke like an Italian from, you know, like I was their mother. You know, ideas of things and stuff, and
because you learn from your parents, right?
And that's when I actually realized that my parents were not just Italian; they were Italian from the 50s. They never way of speaking, their way of thought, even though they went back and forth because my family was all in Italy, especially on my father's side. So they didn't evolve with them. And so I'm wondering, you know, there was this detachment between the cultures of the people of my own age. And so I was always trying to learn more and more, and I realized that most of the ideas that I have were basically intact, thinking from the early 1900s to the 1950s were not at all that different when it came to how the role of women in the family structure. And, you know, my father came to a point that he told me, well, just take whatever degree in college, you know, you're going to be maintained anyway, you know. And that was,
that was the thinking.
And I didn't relate to that because even though my mom was traditional, my mom just wanted, as a World War II survivor, she wanted to make me independent. She wanted me to always be independent. And so,
but Italian men have a tendency to think little of women. No, not anymore. And then, especially, which part of Italy were your parents from?
Well, my mom is from Sardinia, and even though she was born in Rome, she's really from Sardinia.
And your father?
And my father is from Sicily.
I was going to say that there is a huge difference between the north of Italy and the south of Italy.
Yes.
And I was born in the north, so it's a much more open society in this respect. And your parents came from the most, you know, traditional and sexist society
Let me put it this way. My mom found out that my father was not from Genova after they got married. Because he did not tell her that he was from Sicily.
You know, I'm going to make you laugh now. My grandmother, when I was a kid, she kept telling me as her life lesson, marry anybody you want, but don't marry a Sicilian. That was her.
Yeah, we still joke around with
wisdom.
Him.
Yeah.
You know, he's changed a lot. Let me tell you, when he moved to the U.S., he's changed a lot. But
but actually, let's not, you know, give the wrong idea. The South of Italy is a great place to go. People are warm and friendly, and they're phenomenal. It's just that if you want to go visit, actually, the South of Italy it's a much more interesting place than the North. Is that if you have to live there and if you have to grow children there, then that is a problem.
Yeah. I love all Italy. I've been everywhere. We toured, you know, by car, and I love the little towns everywhere, north, central, and south. And what I think is, it's just they're all warm. They're all family oriented. They just are very particular in their ideas. And
yes, they are.
And they, you know, things have evolved and things have changed. And I think that the idea that I have in my head is even outdated in many cases. So,
well, but, you know, I'll give you a very good example. My son, who grew up in the United States with me in, you know, several different places in the States and went to college in the States and then decided that he wanted to go and live in Italy because he wanted to learn more about, he was born there, but he came with me when he was like 2 years old or something.
Mm-hmm.
So and that he totally fell in love with the south of Italy. He's been living in Naples for a few years now, and when he's not in Naples, he spends some time in Puglia, in Calabria, in Sicily, in all those places. He loves the people. He just loves the south of Italy, and he would not live in the north if you put a gun to his head. So, you see?
Yeah, and
he was born and raised in the States. So.
Yeah, it's amazing where life takes us. When you look back through all your struggles and all your life, or everything that you went through to be where you are now, and you look at the stories that you portray, do you think that you're staying true to this culture changes and old times, you know, because I'm looking at your novels at 1910, they all set up in Italy, and they all have female characters. So is this a theme that goes with you, or do you plan to write different...
No, I'm sort of moving away from that. I wanted to write those two novels because Genoa is not on the beaten path of American tourists, and yet it is a magnificent city. And it has a very interesting history, and that is one of the reasons that I chose to write those two novels in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Genoa was always a very big port city. The port is the biggest in the Mediterranean, so it always had a very strong working class, and then had a very strong upper class, kind of not much in between. And this was certainly more true than, you know, in the past than it is today, where the classes are more blended in. So I wanted to write one novel set in the working class environment, that's the Santa Rosa Zoia, and then a second novel set in the upper class environment, and that's the House of Serenades. And if somebody reads both books, they have a very good picture of what this city looks like from two very different perspectives. So that is sort of a finished task. And the one novel that I'm writing right now, it is actually set in the United States, although so many people have roots in Genoa, so there are parts of the novel that go back. But I'm slowly moving my writing more into the United States.
If, you know, we're getting, I want to tell your people your website and where they can find out more about your books. It's linasimoni.com, and that is L-I-N-A-S-I, M as in mother, O-N as in no, I.com. I really encourage everyone to check out your website. You have beautiful art there, too. And one question that has been intriguing me all throughout the conversation is what do you expect, or what would you, not expect, what would you wish that women in general got from your books, women's, the characters? Is there anything that you wish that they could relate to, or how do you think current women
I'm sure that there are lots of women out there who struggle to find their place in the world, and I hope that by reading my novels, they would find strength and the courage to stand up for what they believe in.
Yeah, and it's true. There's more and more women are coming forth looking for the life that they were meant to live, I think.
Yes, and it's really, you know, a very good thing that there's, you know, more of that attitude.
Yeah. Lina, where can people buy your books other than your website?
Actually, they're all on Amazon.com and BarnesandNobles.com. So those are, you know, two places that people can go and buy the books. They're also in bookstores, I believe, although not all, you know, the bookstore will have all the books. And then all the books are available in Kindle, Nook, and iPad versions. And I must mention that the third book I wrote is a children's book. I'll just mention it briefly. It's called Sophia's Rainbow, and it's a beautiful children's book that I wrote and somebody else illustrated, and it's getting 5-star reviews everywhere. So that is also available everywhere, basically.
That's cool. And again, your website is linasimoni.com, and that's L-I-N as in no, A-S, M as in mother, O N as in no, I.com.
And then, of course, I offer the, what everybody has, a Facebook site, a YouTube channel, so just go and find me. I'm everywhere.
But to be honest, all you need is Google. Just Google Lena and you'll find her everywhere. But thank you so much for being with us. This was a great interview. I really enjoyed
it. Thank you. I truly enjoyed it because I guess we had so much in common that the interview came easy, I guess. And
Yeah. I encourage everybody to check out your book. The last one is The House of Serenades. And in her website, again, linasimoni.com. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Thank you, Lena.
Thank you, Susan.
And listeners, until next time.